This is Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls. The program reflects the views and opinions of its host and guests, and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of its members, staff, or underwriters. I'm Margot Patterson, the producer of this week's show. I'll be talking today to Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law and former UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine. But first, news. Last week, Israel's Supreme Court ruled that a group of four Palestinian families slated to be evicted from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem can stay in their homes for the time being. The ruling culminates a decades-long struggle by the families to remain in their homes and could ease tensions in East Jerusalem, where the evictions of the four families, and potentially many more, have become a flashpoint for conflict, sparking in 2021 an 11-day war between Israel and Hamas. The new ruling leaves the final status of the property open to a decision by Israel's Ministry of Justice, which could take years to decide. Destruction of Palestinian properties in the occupied West Bank is proceeding more rapidly under the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett than under the prior administration, according to data from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. The tally of demolitions carried out since Biden took office 13 months ago surpassed 1,000, with over 1,300 Palestinians displaced by the demolitions. At a similar point in President Donald Trump's term, and with Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister, Israeli officials had demolished 379 structures, displacing nearly 600 Palestinians, less than half the number of demolitions occurring under Biden and Bennett. Experts say the accelerating pace of Israel's demolitions is a result of Biden's refusal to pressure Bennett over Palestinian rights. My guest today is Richard Falk, the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University. In addition to the many books he's co-written and edited, he is the author of 20 books, including a recently published memoir, Public Intellectual, The Life of a Citizen Pilgrim. In it, he writes about his life and the often controversial public stance he's taken during the course of it, particularly on U.S. foreign policy and its failure to respect international law. From 2008 to 2014, Professor Falk was UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel since 1967. He continues to write and speak on Israel-Palestine and on other issues. Richard Falk, thank you for joining us today. It's a privilege to have you on the show.
I'm glad to be with you and look forward to our conversation.
I can't help but ask you about the recent crisis in Ukraine that the world is focusing on. Obviously, there are contrasts to be made with other conflicts that are going on in the world. You've spent your life thinking and writing about international law. What are your thoughts on the conflict in Ukraine? And are there aspects to it involving international law that Americans need to be more cognizant of?
Yes, that's a very relevant way of phrasing the question. There's no doubt in my mind that the Russian attack on Ukraine, even if it was somewhat provoked, violate the fundamental norm prohibiting aggressive uses of force and interferences with the territorial sovereignty and self-determination of a sovereign state. That much is clear. But there's another level that is often not understood very well, even by people that should be well acquainted with the way international politics operate. And that's what I call the geopolitical level, which has, unfortunately, in some respects, been embedded in the UN Charter itself in the form of giving the five victorious powers in World War II a permanent seat on the Security Council and the right to veto any decision that is contrary to their perceived national interest. That, in effect, is saying international law is not relevant for these five permanent members. And interestingly, they claim impunity and have not joined the International Criminal Court to make them even less accountable to international law. This means that geopolitics unfolds by the practice of the geopolitical actors. It creates a second normative level of international political life. And unfortunately, in the context of Ukraine, the U.S. has been responsible for doing to other countries precisely what Russia claims entitled to do to the Ukraine. The most relevant recent example is the George W. Bush war in Iraq of 2003, which sought UN approval but was denied. And President Bush at that time said, "This shows the irrelevance of the UN and international law to the behavior that the US and the UK were embarked upon." So what one has is a precedent rather firmly established. It's not only Iraq, but Afghanistan and a whole bunch of other countries, Libya, in some ways, Afghanistan and Syria. There's a strong geopolitical precedent for the Russian position on the Ukraine. That doesn't mean that it's legal or morally acceptable, but it does make the U.S. stand seem hypocritical in many ways. And the outpouring of compassion and the acceptance of refugees, it really exhibits a double standard when there are many more refugees were generated by the Syrian conflict and were not only not welcomed, they were excluded from European countries. So in short, the international way of handling aggressive force is very, what I would call, bifocal. There's one law for the ordinary sovereign states. There's another set of precedents and practices by the geopolitical actors. And that's the world we're in.
The international community has responded with swift, severe actions against the Russian invasion. Could you compare the international responses to the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the response to the now more than 50 years of Israeli military occupation and colonization of Palestinian land gained by conquest in 1967?
It illustrates very vividly the points I was trying to make. The primacy of geopolitics has allowed the United States to shield Israel from accountability to international law, and the control of the international political discourse has allowed a general condemnation of Palestinian resistance. Whereas we're celebrating Ukrainian resistance, Palestinian resistance to what has been recently rather authoritatively called the apartheid nature of the Israeli state, that not only doesn't evoke empathy, it is repudiated by the United States and to some extent Europe, and results in giving Israel impunity, whereas there are these sanctions being imposed on Russia and it's being held accountable. And this makes another point. At the end of the Cold War, the U.S. emerged as the only effective geopolitical actor in the world. It was called the unipolar moment. That meant that what the U.S. attempted didn't really take advantage of the end of the Cold War to disarm or get rid of nuclear weapons, etc. But what it did was to try to achieve a hegemonic form of geopolitical dominance. By that I mean everywhere in the world became part of U.S. security concerns, and countries like China and Russia, formerly great powers, were denied control over their spheres of influence. See, part of the geopolitical level of world order is that these geopolitical actors protect not only their territory, but a expanded conception of territory that includes what the Russians call their near abroad, and what we in the, for a long time, validated in terms of the Monroe Doctrine and the Roosevelt Corollary, which claimed rights of intervention throughout the Western Hemisphere to protect American interests. And it continues with Cuba and Venezuela at the present time, more than 60 years after the Cuban change of government through an internal political revolution, we still impose sanctions on Cuba, which in effect says Cuban rights of self-determination, which they possess under international law, have no impact on our geopolitical claim to uphold ideological purity within our sphere of influence.
And am I right in thinking that geopolitical claim basically amounts to might makes right?
Great might makes right. Or put it another way, great might makes great right. Or when the most powerful state or states act outside the scope of international law, when they're using force, but invoke international law when their adversaries use force and do basically the same thing, that underscores the moral hypocrisy. In one context, international law is used as hostile propaganda. In the other context, it's just ignored because inconvenient.
In your writings, you talked about how international law is on the side of the Palestinians, but the political will necessary to enforce it is absent because of Israel and the United States. The other international actors, could they be doing more with respect to Palestine than they're doing to enforce international law?
Yes, they should be doing more than they're doing, but they have other national interests. And the U.S. and to some extent Israel are very good at twisting arms to achieve compliance with their geopolitical preferences. Might doesn't quite make right, but it shapes interest in the world. So Trump, for instance, in his last months, initiated these normalization agreements with Arab neighbors of Israel, which had long said we will not enter normal relations until there's a just peace for the Palestinians. But he, in effect, bribed these governments by offering arms deals and doing other favors to enter these kind of relationships. That had nothing to do with international law.
You spent your 6 years as UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights documenting the evolving nature of Israeli oppression. Israel refused to allow you into the country to see for yourself what was going on. How were you able to work around that? And could you describe the changes in behavior you saw while you held that office and what you see happening now?
The way I worked around it as best I could was to meet people in neighboring countries, and at the time to gain access to Gaza by way of Egypt, which was even in the last stages of Mubarak and then in the brief period following Mubarak, willing to facilitate access to Gaza for someone like me without having to go through Israeli immigration. As far as the changes, there were no positive changes on the ground that I could document in any way that were favorable to the Palestinians. If anything, the situation became more severe, deprivation of basic human rights, and the very prolonged nature of the occupation was itself a very cruel kind of imposition on Palestinian rights and well-being. What I think was achieved and is often overlooked is that the finding of illegitimacy on the part of Israel in its mode of occupation has a big symbolic importance in determining what is right and wrong in international society and affects directly civil society. The reason that Israel is so eager to discredit the BDS campaign, for instance, is that it's effective in mobilizing global solidarity. It's really a global solidarity initiative that was very effective against South Africa and led to the dismantling of apartheid. And Israelis are sophisticated in their understanding that they're not so vulnerable to armed attack, but they are vulnerable to this kind of global solidarity movement that delegitimizes their behavior. And so their effort is to criminalize those that would delegitimize it. So it's a kind of struggle in this, what I call the symbolic domain of politics. They defy international law and do so with impunity, but they can't defy this symbolic level of politics because it doesn't deal only with governments, but with social movements and with transnational civil society. And it creates a sense of isolation on the part of Israel if the pressure grows very intense. Interestingly, the country that is most militant at a governmental level about the wrongdoing in Israel is none other than South Africa, because it endured what the Palestinians are enduring. And some of the most qualified South African jurists, like John Dugard, for instance, says he grew up in apartheid South Africa, that what the Palestinians is experiencing is in many ways worse than what Africans experience in the South African period of apartheid.
I was interested that you mentioned that not only the Israel and the United Nations, but the Palestinians have all focused on the issue of territoriality, and you think that's a mistake. You believe the emphasis should be replaced by one on people and equality. Could you talk about that?
Yes, that's another one of these issues that isn't very widely understood, in my view. Israel, at its origins, was faced with this demographic challenge. It wanted to be a democratically constituted state, but that meant it had to get rid of a lot of Palestinians living within the area designated for Israel by the UN partition resolution. So it basically created conditions that made as many as 700,000 Palestinians leave what is now Israel and made sure they wouldn't come back. It destroyed 570 Palestinian villages and denied the international legal right of refugees to return to their homeland. And this was all part of an anxiety that you couldn't have a Jewish democratic state unless you controlled the number of Palestinians. So you had to disperse the Palestinians. So the victims of this kind of Zionist project were people as well as the encroachment on territory. And the people were the fundamental victim, living generation after generation in these refugee camps in neighboring countries, subject to a lot of abuses from that kind of status, and having no real options to protect their dignity, much less their right. The politics of dispersal was integral to the establishing of a Jewish state in Israel, and it continues to be.
During the 6 years that you served as UN Special Rapporteur, you were frequently and savagely attacked, not only by Israel and the pro-Israel lobby in this country, but even by U.S. government officials, too. John Bolton, UN ambassadors, Susan Rice, Samantha Power, Nikki Haley, and others. Often you mentioned they would quote defamatory statements without troubling to speak to you and verify if they were true. Despite your being Jewish, you were accused of being an anti-Semite and a Jew hater. The pillaging of your character even took place in Kansas City, where the Kansas City Star published a column by a syndicated columnist named Joel Brinkley, who said, "If you're looking for someone to loathe, I have a strong candidate to offer." And he then names you. That must have been a very difficult time in your life. I'm wondering if you were ever tempted to temper your criticism of Israel. What gave you the courage to continue to call out Israel for its abuses of human rights?
The first part of your question, I think I was animated by my contact with the existential suffering of the Palestinian people and balancing all that defamatory criticism that I received was a good deal of praise from other sources, because my experience was much more balanced and I got considerable satisfaction out of the sense that a lot of people around the world thought I was doing a good job, especially under these circumstances. And I mean, the fact of these prominent people attacking me without bothering to scrutinize the reality is for me a metaphor of the way in which a know-nothing attitude underpins this unconditional support of Israel that is bipartisan in character. The list of people you mentioned, some are Republicans, some were Democrats. And that is very inconsistent with the true values of a democratic society, where you try to find out what the reality is. You don't make these kinds of emotive connections that lead to the denial of the relevance of the facts and the law. And that's what's happened for Democrats as well as Republicans. They don't want to see the reality because it's inconvenient.
Well, let me ask you about that know-nothingness. Don't you think Susan Rice and Samantha Power must have understood the problem?
Yes, but that makes it worse. I mean, they not only understood, I knew some of these people, at least to some extent, and they definitely understood. I mean, their understanding was you can't be politically viable in the U.S. unless you show your pro-Israeli credential and maintain them. And Samantha Power was the most flagrant example because she had been a critic of the way in which the Palestinians were being treated until she was nominated to be a UN ambassador. In a way, this connects with our earlier discussion of Ukraine and the U.S. This is on a personal level. You have that same degree of tension between people's careerist ambitions and their own sense of reality. And they sometimes suppress that sense of reality in order to promote their career. Sad but true.
Have you ever had a discussion with somebody who has sacrificed their integrity or their truthfulness in order to be politically effective? And do they ever discuss the internal tensions this causes them, or do you think it really doesn't cause them too many internal tensions?
Well, it's so prevalent that I think it doesn't cause as many internal tensions as you would expect or maybe even hope. But over the years, especially during my 40 years at Princeton, a lot of people pass through there that have considerable access to Washington, and they would tell me if I wanted to be effective, I should temper my views, not only on Palestine, but on other issues. and that the best way to exert influence was to talk privately with people in important policy positions, some of whom I knew from my academic experience at Yale and Harvard, and as well as Princeton. I had an overdose of Ivy League education, pedagogy. But it seems very difficult, and it shouldn't be, in a democratic society, for one to privilege conscience over career. And to me, that's sort of the ultimate position. And there were a number of people at Princeton, for instance, who agreed with me, let's say 90%. But they agreed with me in cocktail parties, not in any kind of public discourse. And that's only partly careerist. It's partly also a sense that you shouldn't be a public intellectual. You should be, if you want to be an effective academic, you should be a private intellectual or academic intellectual, library intellectual, library and classroom intellectual. You shouldn't be an engaged citizen. See, and that's part of the tension. And there are very few people that have followed this path. I mean, I had no true companion at Princeton, not for my views, but for my feeling that action as a citizen was part of my identity as a professor.
That brings me to another question I have for you, which is about the subtitle of your book, which is The Life of a Citizen Pilgrim, which I think is a wonderful phrase. Could you talk about what that phrase means?
It's derived from the letter of Paul in the New Testament, where he talks about one of the letters of Paul, I believe, to the Thessalonians. I'm not sure about that, or the Corinthians. But in any event, in that letter, he talks about faith being confidence in the unseen, and that the pilgrim is one who strives for a better future, is not content with things as they are, but wishes to see a more desirable state of affairs. So for me, that combination of a certain kind of intuitive confidence in the future, enabling human agency to create a more peaceful and just future, combined with the notion that we don't have it now, that it's sort of, I've been a critic of so-called world citizen, because there's no global community, and citizenship depends on some sort of social contract and shared values, and they don't really exist, or they exist at such a weak level that it's misleading to speak of international community.
Richard Falk, thank you so much for talking to me today.
I've enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
I've been talking to Richard Falk, an expert on international law. His memoir, Public Intellectual, was recently published. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.